Hello. To go on from the fine words of our last speaker, when are we going to get some political solution to the problem? Because as you've said, in America, it seems it's one thing that can unite Republicans and Democrats. Republicans like the clean slate because it gives them cheap, talented labor, like the three people like you. The Democrats seem to be more concerned with compassionate justice, but they're both united, and many of the states are cleaning the slate to When will we get to political will here, then?
I can tell you that I don't see there really isn't an advocacy group for prisoners. If you read, let's say you read an article in the paper about a crime of some sort, you read the comment section at the end of it, which I often do. It's like, oh, this person needs to suffer the rest of his life, or never let them out, or if you hear some story about a prisoner having difficulty reintegrating, well, they'll say that's good. Again, I mentioned Americans, you mentioned earlier, the Republicans and Democrats, they just passed prison reform in the U.S. In the U.K., they have a ban the box program where you can't discriminate against employment if someone has a criminal record. In Canada, there really isn't that. So, you know, when I look at job forms or rental applications, it's always on the form. It's always there, and that always haunts you in some sense. Over and above, let's say, Google, if you have a relatively famous crime, as I do. I don't know. There has to be I think there has to be an economic motivation where people say, you know what, spending $200,000 a year keeping a guy in prison, or then when he's out, he can't get a job or a place to live, so we're spending $50,000 on social services or whatever a year. Why don't we just help them reintegrate so they can support themselves and pay taxes? So it's net positive, and, you know, psychologically, socially net positive, also financially net positive. So I think the impetus will probably be economic sooner or later, just because the current model doesn't make any sense.
I've never done this before, but I'm tempted to answer that question in addition. We've been doing this series for 10 years, so those of us who are involved in organizing have learned a little few things along the way. We'd hoped when the Liberal government got in 2015, they would start rescinding all the really lousy stuff the Harper government instituted. I'm talking about a whole raft of minimum time on various charges. I can go on and on about all the horrible things they did. We'd hoped the Liberals, when they got in, would start changing things. They've done nothing, essentially, for the last 3.5 years. Yes, there's a lot of noise about, the solitary confinement thing that added up to nothing. And they've done nothing on any other front. I've become convinced the only way you're going to get change in legislation is you have to embarrass the government. I have seen, all the facts are there for a much more progressive system that would cost less. All the facts are there for a very clear path of reform that would actually save taxpayers' money. Yet they do nothing. Sorry, I will stop there.
Question here.
Sorry, Chris, do you want to talk?
Hello?
Peter, is this going?
Hello?
Sorry, just 1 second, please. This one. Peter?
There it goes.
There we go. There we go, finally.
I think that starts with us, and I don't mean us as, I mean us as a society. A society needs to come together, don't make the offenders. Like, we feel really isolated, we feel like second-class citizens. That's what prison's designed to make us feel like. But the whole mindset starts with the community. Governments can't change society. Communities change society.
First of all, I want to thank these guests for coming here and talking to us. I know it must take a lot of courage to come here and speak to a public and speak frankly and honestly about your feelings and about your past. Not an easy thing to do, and I respect you all very much for that. What I'd like to ask is, it seems to me that the most serious problem that a lot of people coming out of prison have is self-esteem. I'd like to hear from each of you, what was the biggest thing for you that helped you on the path to restoring your self-esteem?
Like I mentioned, definitely it would have to be connecting with these folks that become now has been become my family. There was a tremendous sense of worthlessness because everything gets taken from you. You are only a number. That FPS number is who you are. You have no decision on when you get up, when you go to sleep, when you eat, when you do all of those things. Everything is taken from you. And then, like I said, for myself personally, I was not allowed to talk to my children or have any communication with my children. That was incredibly detrimental to my mental health and emotional well-being. At the same time, you're only allowed to communicate with people who who give permission to be communicated with. So I had asked for permission to communicate with my father. I was there for the phone call, and my father said that he did not want to communicate with me either. That was incredibly heart-wrenching for me, so that's when I decided I didn't want anything with the outside world. You know, I didn't want to live outside because outside hurt. You know, so I blocked all of that. So slowly but surely, just a few people, you know, and it took me a really long time. A very long time. I'm going to say probably over a few years, really, to get that back because my hardest piece was forgiveness. Really hard, you know, because people had to keep reminding me, you know, God's forgiven you, Nikki, and when He wiped the slate clean, so you have to forgive yourself. Because if he doesn't remember, how come you do? It was a really big struggle for me because I knew that there was so much other people that I had affected. It wasn't just that it happened to me and that I did that to that family and I had a victim, but there was such an immense amount of people, my family, my parents, my children. I had disappointed and let down so many people that I really took that out on myself really hard. So building self-esteem for me was something that took a long time. And like I had mentioned before, I just kept praying to God to give me people on my path to help me, you know? And every day I prayed for that. And He has blessed me.
Self-esteem. Like she said, community. My partner has probably been the most supportive person I've met out here, and I've told her my entire life. I've never kept anything back from her. She lets me express who I am, my emotions, my fears. That's really helped a resurgence of my self-esteem. In prison, you develop, even unwillingly, you develop a will to survive because you're put to the sword every day. And so when you get out here, you can take some good things from jail, like that will to survive, and you can push forward. And no matter the amount of rejection you face, you can still keep going. And that every day you see yourself successful out here, it builds on that self-esteem.
For myself, I was a professional before, and there was quite a stigma. I lost, you know, almost all my friends and all my professional contacts when that happened. And so when I got out, I sort of went into a shell, and then to get my self-esteem back, I decided to embrace the stigma. I was involved with a University of Ottawa program where we made an educational documentary using my case as the framework. It's called Collared, and its goal was to prevent crimes or people committing crimes through a focus on the victims. And then when this restorative justice housing opportunity came up, I embraced it and went after it pretty hard because I thought I could make a difference. And again, as I said, when I made that promise in prison, was my goal now going forward is to take something good from that my bad experience, because My prison experience also involved my co-accused committed suicide the day he was going to be sentenced with me. So I've had a double blow. My life was over, my best friend is gone, and everything else fell apart. So instead of focusing on the negative, I said, okay, I'll try to turn that negative into some positive, if not for me, then for someone else down the road. So that's how I've been getting my self-esteem back.
And who has the next question? Right here.
My question is, like, your experiences are different than... How do you deal with a society where police, once you've been arrested and you have this record, and you get out, and the police know who you are, how do you escape that? How do you escape it when the police continually come after you no matter how good you try to be and how you try to clean yourself up? They find some excuse to throw you back into the pit. Like, I don't get it. Like, I understand that 90% of the police force are decent. They're decent people. They're just doing their job. But there are these people out there, they just persecute you. I don't know how anybody can cope with that. I mean, my son just got out and he's back in because he was doing good, but they just found some excuse to throw him back. And I'm at the point where I'm so frustrated that I don't understand how anybody can escape the system.
Well, something I would often say is, I don't know if you agree with it, I always say the system of justice exists for those that administer it. It's not benefiting the people in it. It's not benefiting the victims. It's benefiting the people running it. I know the example you just gave was when I was on parole, I had a police officer knock on my door about between 2 and 4 o'clock every morning for a week, so waking me up just to see that I'm there. Now, if you know my offense was insider trading, I'm not insider trading in the middle of the night. He was just doing it to give me a hard time, I think. And I dealt with it, but I can see other guys being pushed over the edge in that sense. And again, it doesn't benefit anyone in society to send people back for unjustified reasons.
I heard from my brother here the cry from a father of a son who's continually going in and out. And I remember a dad. Can you hear me now? Yeah, I remember a dad speaking to a dad whose son was at the Don jail, and he over coffee, and he said, you know, to his son, every time you come in here, I come in here with you. Families and suffer, and Mary, who is here, is on the board of an organization called Canadian Families and Corrections Network, is there to try to support families and children and so on. But because you go to jail too, this is this whole, you know, this whole catchment of people who suffer because of the victims suffer, the community suffers, but families suffer too. Thank you for raising it. There's another question back here. Oh, sorry, Nikki.
No, all I was going to say is it's a really sad fact of what we always say about this, and I have a friend who's in Joyceville right now, and he just wants to get out, and unfortunately the sad thing that we say about this, and it's something that we counsel everybody, I wouldn't do it, and it's something that I tell all my friends. It's not worth it to go for the day parole. Do your time. Because the system is designed for people to fail. When they tell you it's $168,000 or $200,000 a year to federally house an inmate, it's all staff. You know a female inmate, you know what she gets? A couple of tampons a month. It's all staff. All that money is for staff, it's not for the people. And when they want you to go, when everybody wants to get out on day parole, but it's not worth it, because when you go out on day parole, you got a guy at your door every night or people following you around. You stay there, you finish your time, because when you finish your time and you come out, they can't bug you, they have nothing to come after you for.
My son's done his time. They went back after him, okay? Because they don't like him. Okay? My son did his time.
He did, oh yeah. No, I know the police. Listen, you don't have to tell me. I live in Peel Region, and the police are the biggest gang out there. Trust me, I get it. I get it. It's just a suggestion on time, because I know a lot of people come out on day parole. It doesn't work.
Someone else wanted a question. Yes.
If I may, I have two questions. The first relates to the restorative justice housing piece, and the second has to do with your preparation for parole. And the reason I ask about parole is currently I'm the regional vice chair of the Parole Board of Canada for Ontario and Nunavut. One of the challenges we have regularly when evaluating risk is understanding how people and where people are going to live, particularly those going on full parole situations or setting conditions for statutory release. So I'd like to know a little bit about how you plan to evaluate people who are applying to live in your housing situations. Mm-hmm. And the second question for all of you is about how you're prepared to deal with the parole setting and what the advice you're getting, whether you're coming for parole day or full parole. I won't get into that debate. But we'd be interested in knowing, and I'd be interested in knowing, is the level of preparation that you're receiving so that you can perform best and talk about what your potentials are when you come before my colleagues and I. Thank you very much. Oh, and just in closing, I'd like to thank Eglinton St. George's. This is a tremendous process. And I will simply say that I'm recently appointed, and unlike my previous two incumbents, I'm not a former police officer. So,
regarding restorative justice housing, our focus is going to be on ex-prisoners who have gone through and out of the system. Because if you're still in the system, there's other resources that you can access. Whereas if you've done your time to warrant expiry, you're on your own, basically. And you've had maybe some social services, but you have to find your own place to live at that point in time. Regarding parole, you know, they'll probably agree with me. I think I felt that the hardest time that I had, even though I did time in two max prisons, was on parole. People say the parole time is the hardest time because there's always someone looking over your shoulder. But worse, there's always someone doubting you. You know, you deal with parole. Some parole officers are, you know, have a different attitude that I don't think is positive in the long run for society. So they're always doubting you, questioning you. And I always said that if I ran the system, I would probably reduce parole and increase the halfway house system, because that gives a person a place to live, and from that base they can get counseling and they get support, and they can use that, maybe perhaps find a job and then find a place to live afterwards. I did not find, and my own experience of people who've been through parole, I knew many of them, I did not find they benefited from it, because I didn't think parole was helping them prepare for post-parole into society. I thought it was a time that people just had to avoid getting in trouble or having a deteriorating attitude, which is something that you can be sent back to prison for a deteriorating attitude. And that's so subjective. That might be you just disagree with an opinion. And myself, I'll tell you my own story. I was living on my own, had a job, and I switched parole officers. And then I met this new parole officer, and then within 1 hour of meeting me, after I'd been on my own for 11 months, she revoked my parole, suspended my parole, after 1 hour of meeting me. Which my first parole officer took that as a rebuke to her, and then eventually I had my parole suspension hearing, which I won. But the time, the waste, I lost my job, lost my place to live, the cost to society, it was ridiculous. So I don't have a very high opinion of parole system, no offense to you, obviously. But I think that's an area, if you want to reform it for the benefit of society, I would change it from more of a monitoring system to looking for failure to how we can help people succeed to get out of the system and never come back.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, yeah. For me, I prepared everything and did everything on my own for preparing for my parole. I attempted to write letters to my victim's family. They were invited, they didn't come. I made all arrangements for my halfway house. Even after an extensive time in the institution, I still prepared to go into a drug treatment program, doing urinalysis. I asked for my urinalysis to continue beyond what parole wanted it to be, just for my kind of a safety net. Any additional programs and anything that I did outside, I prepared for all of those things just to make sure that everything went smoothly. It's definitely looking for you to fail. I had a situation myself, even one day where they wanted to pull my parole over something ridiculous, just being down the street from the house on the way back from the drugstore, actually. From picking something up and getting into something, and you know, yeah, exactly, over somebody not liking the, you know, a disagreement of opinion. And that's an automatic, you know, revoke. So it's always looking for anything that we can send you back, you know, and that's for the extension. Myself, because of my charge, it came with an extensive driving prohibition, and the judge made that wasn't going to start until the end of my parole. So I had some pretty crazy conditions that they could have stuck me on for like a 10-year supervisory position. So yeah, it's terrifying, because even though, you know, you're not doing anything and you're out there doing all the right stuff, and I'm working in the community and I'm going to school and I'm doing all that stuff, you know, you hear police or you see police and you're nervous, you know, and you're worried, and it's not a very nice way to live, you know. It's not a very nice way to live.
Hi, thank you for your sharings this afternoon. I have been married to two alcoholics. One of them died of the disease, cirrhosis of the liver. The second husband did spend some time in jail during our marriage, but it was just sort of a few days. He was put on parole, and I lived with that, and we also lived with sobriety. Sobriety for him played miracles in his life, and it did in my life, because I also belong to Al-Anon. And I was just wondering, with the principles of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the principles of Al-Anon, which is for the families and friends of alcoholics, has that had any influence on your staying safe in our society today? To any of you can answer that question.
I think that principles of all groups like that, or anything that has to do with people's well-being, health, mentally, emotionally, physically, and otherwise, are a very serious part of a foundation of our health and well-being, absolutely. Very important. They are all part of inside, and definitely a part of outside. I can tell you for myself, 100%, and I can tell you for a lot of people that I know personally and I can see, that I've seen, that any of us that have come from from the depths of addiction and have a longevity in sobriety have had a spiritual experience. You have to. If you don't, it doesn't work.
One at the back.
At the back, yeah? At the back.
Try. Thank you very much. I've been thinking about the comments about the political system. Sorry. And I'm wondering... Okay. And I'm wondering how many people who've been through these kinds of experiences participate in the political process in terms of helping in campaigns and understanding it in a slightly different way and finding opportunities to maybe influence a riding association, influence a political party's political policy, get to know somebody who wins. Even if you don't win, get to know somebody. It's a very neighborly, community-based activity.
I can tell you my own personal experience after I was released. I intentionally tried to get a job as a polling officer during the last two elections, and I've actually worked as a polling officer. It was my way of saying, like, I have a criminal record, but I'm part of society still, because Canadians who have criminal records can vote. So I consciously want to participate in that process to give back, like I'm still part of everyone else, even though I have a criminal record. And that was interesting. And I was very open about it with the people working there, because people think, oh, you can do this with a criminal record? I said, yeah, I can vote and I can work as a polling officer. And I think it really changed their views towards ex-prisoners in that sense. But I have not worked for any political party specifically. Just I wanted to participate in the process. So I thought it was important.
I think that's really important. important to work as a polling officer, and it's fun, eh? I mean, you enjoy
it. It's a long day. It's a very long day. That's right.
Yeah, I know. It's a very long day, but still, it's a community kind of thing. I think in the long run, though, you can have more impact if you start as a volunteer on a campaign, and you probably know that the, for example, if you're an MP, then you're the one officially who there's a certain number of jobs as an electoral officers. Do you follow me? So in a way, if you want to get to know somebody, if you want to get to know the process, if you work in a campaign or join a riding association, you have more chance in your neighborhood of being part of it. And then you can go on and get a job as a poll clerk or whatever's available.
I think I'll start the ex-prisoner party. I got 3 votes. That's
but
it. Thank you.
I don't want to criticize you for the ex-prisoner party, but I think you have more more impact if you integrate, because you get to know a whole wide variety of people, right from the person who's the most down and out to somebody who's very wealthy, influential, and might be a really decent kind of person.
I will consider it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. What about you, too? Do you...
Did you want to... Just being on the board of RJHO, as Joseph said, we have a lead on 2 houses, but we've had a very difficult time finding housing. Been, you know, looking for a couple of months, and we've got turned down, about 50 times. So anybody that hears about a house or is open to renting an investment house that they have, we would really welcome it, because it really makes a difference if you can get, say, 3 guys or 3 women living together. You know, they've got the peer support, which is really key in the reintegration. So we just throw that out and ask people. And Joseph's gone through a lot of stress looking for places. And
we don't discriminate against landlords. Let's put it that way. We'll take anyone as a landlord. You can have a criminal record. I don't mind.
Hello. So I just wanted to thank everyone just for sharing your stories. There's nothing like hearing a personal story to help you really understand and kind of walk a little bit in someone else's shoes. I know a lot of people who have heard you speak were very moved by what you've shared, and I'm just wondering if anyone who is up there has any specific suggestions on how each of us or our community can get involved in a way to help prisoners integrate in life and become part of the community, and you know, what are specific things we can do?
One of my favorite quotes is from the liberation theologian Gustavo Gutierrez, who says, "One cannot be in solidarity with the poor unless one knows the names of poor people." And so, in whatever ways you can, to meet, to listen to stories, to spend time with people, I think that's where we begin, because unless we're fueled by the knowledge of what our friend has said, from what we have heard and what we have seen, I mean, that can fuel our action. That's how Circles of Support started, because I knew the guy when the psychologist called me and said he's coming out and he's nowhere to go. And Dismas, because we saw the difficulties that ex-prisoners had in finding communities, even faith communities that would accept them. So because it's listening. And that's why Jim, when he heard the cry from our conferences, "I have nowhere to live. Where can we find a place to live?" So I think that to come alongside, in whatever ways, through Circles of Support or the Dismas or volunteer works with other organizations, to be fueled by that. Some of you are in the book clubs, for example. I know they're going to book reading with people. So I think it starts there. And then just let your imagination be released. My thought.
I agree with that. No, you can look at the rjho.ca website.
Yeah.
But if you encounter someone with a criminal record, and maybe in the past your natural reaction would be to shun them or keep them away or be wary, help them feel welcome a bit, because I think most people who've been to prison, they want to reintegrate, they want to be part of society, and it just beats them down over and over again to be rejected by society. So just one welcoming hand can make the world of difference to somebody. So I tell you to do that.
I guess through life experience and through reading, I've long been of the opinion that incarceration is the worst possible solution, except in a few cases where you need to keep people off the street or to save society. But I'm just so interested right now in hearing from each of you what, in retrospect, you feel would have been a much better solution rather than the punishment of jail. I mean, I think that's important. Would it have been a financial fine in your case? Would it have been, I think you could have learned not to fight. You didn't have to go to jail. And at the lady at the end, I think you could have spent much better time with your children. You would have never killed another person in an accident. That's my question.
In my own case, I lost all my money. So I did pay, in a sense, the fine of losing everything. I would prefer house arrest if I could have, because you know, I go from the street to maximum security prisons who've never been in prison before. And it was mentioned earlier, having an FPS number. So when you go in the prison system, they give you a number. I had never been in the prison systems, so I didn't have a number. And because I didn't have a number, I couldn't order canteen food. So for the longest time, I couldn't get stamps to write letters home. So I would trade food for stamps because I'd never been through the system before. So they didn't have a record of me through the canteen system. I would have preferred house arrest if it was offered. It wasn't offered, unfortunately. So I had to do the time like everyone else. It was very difficult. I don't see how society benefited by it, because I wasn't going to commit another crime like that again, and didn't have access to even the ability to do that crime again. So putting me in a maximum security prison, you know, fully secure for this, I did about 27 or 28 months all told of all these different institutions. That didn't seem to be beneficial from a societal standpoint. If you're a taxpayer, it didn't make any sense. So there might be alternative sentencing that might have been appropriate in my case.
Death.
I would have had an opportunity at house arrest. Unfortunately, because I was living in such a sad state and spent my whole days being addicted to drugs and getting high constantly, and that day, when I went to court for my sentencing, I was in a horrible state. So the judges actually, in his first words to me were, "You are pathetic, and I have but a modicum of self-pity for you." So I didn't get house arrest. He made an absolute example out of me with my sentence and with my driving prohibition and with everything. So the fortunate thing for me was I had somebody there from Elizabeth Fry, and I had somebody there from Guelph, from an institution, from a
Homewood.
Thank you. Just to speak to the fact that, you know, due to all the psychological stuff that I was going through and with the state of my drug addiction, that warehousing me in a provincial institution wasn't going to do me any good, and I really needed to be in a federal place where I could receive psychiatric help and where I could receive drug treatment, you know. So I did drug treatment programs inside, and I did all the counseling and all the things I could do outside. And like I said, I made arrangements for myself to continue doing a long-term in-house drug treatment program when I was released. That's the only reason I received the sentence that I did.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering if one of the reasons that so many members of the public retribution rather than rehabilitation.
Hello? Yeah, I was just wondering, is it possible that the reason so many members of the public believe in retribution rather than rehabilitation, and they don't care if people get beat up in prison, and they don't care if they're turned down for jobs because of that box on the form when they get out, I wonder if it's because so many people believe in the pre-scientific religious concept of free will, when maybe you know, a liberal church like the United Church is not a factor here, but those other churches, you know, maybe some people would say that's an obstacle, the religious belief in free will. Would Mr. High could maybe comment on that?
I'm not sure if I've really got the question. Do you think it's our theological basis that creates this problem?
Well, people believe that people freely decided to carry out a crime when, in fact, statistically, you can correlate them to economics, psychiatry, and a million other factors. But people feel that, and from a utilitarian perspective, it doesn't make sense to make someone suffer because they've committed a crime. It would make more sense to help them get back on their feet and not hold their criminal record against them. So, but members of the public, and the reason politicians don't do anything, because so many members of the public think they should suffer, not only in jail and when they get beat up, but when they get out and they can't get a job. And from a utilitarian perspective or a scientific perspective, it doesn't make sense when so many have addiction issues, psychiatric issues, economic issues, and of course there are lots of studies on this. I do think the concept of free will is one reason there's so much. Well, that's why politicians don't do anything, is because the public doesn't want them to do anything.
Do you have a question
I think the question of societal attitudes is a really profound one. I think it is shaped by maybe something that's pretty primitive within us, a need to see blood shed. You know, I mean, we're looking at very primitive theological archetypes. Maybe our own theological constructs contribute to it. The idea of vicarious atonement, the idea that you can somehow, maybe people have to be deterred and because put away somehow to appease the suffering of us all. I don't know. But there is something that the media knows, that if they can run front page stories about people who have done terrible things, that it sells. So there's something there that's very base and primitive within us that wants punishment. I don't know how we move that to a situation that says we're releasing our neighbors. The understanding that it's our sons and daughters and nephews and nieces that are inside, and they're going to be coming out. 95% are coming out. You know, how to see them as neighbors who will be living among us. I don't know how we make that change, that whole paradigm shift. But I think particularly for people in the faith community, in the Christian faith community, it's very clear where God identifies with the least. He identifies with people in prison. He identifies with people who suffer, and that we have to stand on their side. I don't know if that answers it, but that's a big, big question you're raising.
Let me just intervene for a second. We're at 2:00 now. We've been here for an hour and a half. You've all been very patient. What I'm going to suggest, we'll take one more question here. But if those people, thank you, Adam, those people who would like to talk with the panelist or with Harry, you're welcome to do so, and everybody can convene in the Eglinton room. That's where we had lunch, okay? And if you just want to chat with each other, that's a place you can just gather and chat with each other as well as chat with the panelists. I assume you guys have a little more time to do that. That would be great. Okay. So our last question, Anne, what?
Cup near you, could you please pick up the cup and take it to the kitchen? That would be helpful.
Okay. Good afternoon. My question is regarding the restorative justice for housing, and you talk about the integration back into society. Are we talking, the homes that you were talking about, are they a mixed home with male and female? Or are we talking strictly male, strictly female, just like back in prison?
It would be strictly male and strictly female. And the homes would be a regular condo that you might rent or a regular townhouse that you might live in. So these aren't a unique. They're on the market. We're paying market rent, and we're filling them with three people, three females or three males at each location.
So where's the integration?
The integration, well, you want men and women living in an apartment together? I guess that's possible.
I guess a husband and wife live together.
Well, that's true, but these are three strangers, in a sense. You know, I guess you want to learn to walk before you can run. I think we want to succeed in one level before we move on to some larger social statement about integration, men and women in the same housing unit.
I have to disagree with that. I kind of agree with him. You guys should integrate it. You're building laws like the laws you don't like, and that's the segregation, keeping men away from women and women away from men, and that makes people feel isolated and second class. And well, there must be something different from me than from those people over there. Mm.
Well, again, it's something we consider. We're just starting off, and I think
we have to find a house first
or two houses first. And there is more of a need for men than women in society, male ex-prisoners. So we're going to try to meet the needs as best we can, and then maybe we'll be here in 5 years from now. We can tell you, yes, we have 20 units, and some of them are integrated. We have no prohibition against it, but we're trying to meet the immediate need first, and that's largely men and largely a unit that will take three people together.
Okay, that wraps up our Q&A, and I'm going to ask Jim Black here, the co-chair, to give our thanks to our guests today.
For 10 years, we've been gathering like this through the fall and winter, and for the most part, there are luminaries, notables, with a platform and some visibility. But they operate at the 30,000 level altitude levels. And we appreciate their contribution and how they have helped shape the conversation. What we experienced today was something on the ground. These are men and women who have experienced the starkness and the daunting darkness of the correctional services. And I don't think we've had this kind of candor and this kind of unvarnished observation before. So all the more grateful that you three came, and we appreciate your honesty and directness. And Harry, thank you no less. Thank you.